right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, February 18th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Good morning and happy Wednesday. It is 8 degrees and sunny here in upstate New York. So definitely an improvement over the last few days, if you can call it such. Hope everyone down in the southeast is doing okay. I saw there was lots of rain and snow and ice, but that should be over. Octavia, I believe, is blowing off the coast. And what did I see the next storm was called that came from southwest Texas? Is Pandora. Look out, Pandora. Here she comes. I got to say, I didn't realize that Mardi Gras had started. I saw the crazies with beads and stuff yesterday. And down in Mexico to celebrate, I don't know, is it the beginning or the end of Lent? No, don't ask me. One of the Lentian beginnings or ends, they used exploding sledgehammers in Mexico to celebrate. So let that mean that spring is coming soon, because I have had enough of the cold and enough of being a prisoner in my own home just about. This is absolutely ridiculous. So yesterday, let's see, we ended up the show talking about artificial intelligence, neural networks, and DNA that can be used as storage for a million years, encapsulated in little tiny glass balls. We also talked about DNA barcoding and being able to barcode every life form on Earth by using small segments of DNA. Yes, that is the state that we're at. You know, people still seem to think that this stuff is science fiction, and it absolutely is not. I want to continue now and get a little bit more back into not only nanotech, but we're going to tie back in some more GMO stuff. I want to look at some of the RNAi technologies that are being used in our food. And remember, that is some of the same technology we touched briefly on Ebola yesterday in regards to Bob Simon. Bob Simon was a CBS reporter who died in the car crash in New York City last week. And his last report had been on 60 Minutes covering some of the GMO tobacco Ebola vaccine that they were working on. So we'll use that as kind of a little connecting point here. I'm trying to think of where I want to start, though. There's a whole bunch of stuff. I had a bunch of clips sent to me this morning that made me a little bit distracted. Here was one. We talked about this before. I had mentioned this a while ago, early months of 2014. I had talked about this, and then I mentioned it again a couple weeks ago. But there was a news story that came out in Scientific American about the very same thing that we'd been discussing, biodefense. And remember, this was DARPA. DARPA had come up with a way to put each of our bodily systems onto a computer chip and then connect them all together to do drug testing. Well, here we go. Scientific American, February 17, 2015. Biodefense aims to simulate human bodies by linking mini, quote unquote, organs on chips. So here we go. 3D systems could mimic human physiology and allow for ethical tests of the impact of potential biological, chemical, and radiological warfare agents. How nice is that? So no more poor bunnies or beagles. Each year, the U.S. government spends hundreds of millions of dollars stockpiling countermeasures for potential biological, chemical, and radiological warfare agents. And just so you know, that hundreds of millions of dollars that they spend, they're giving to these universities to be doing all this crazy-ass research. For ethical reasons, though, many of these treatments have never been tested in humans. Yes, unless they've declared a state of emergency. And then they can take these brand new vaccines like the RNAi Ebola vaccine and test them for the first time ever in the Africans. But now, the U.S. military and civilian science agencies are supporting the development of the next best thing for tests, miniature human organs on plastic chips. Quote, it is unethical to expose humans to the kind of radiation. Like, I can't, when I read this, I was like, oh my God, like, do one thing but say another. And people are just so stupid that they're going to believe what you say because they haven't been paying close enough attention to see what you do. So he says, quote, it is unethical to expose humans to the kind of radiation that you'd see in a disaster like Fukushima, but you need to be prepared. How about all those homeless men that have been working for almost 4 years in Fukushima Daiichi, all contracted by the Yuzuka, the organized crime mob in Japan? How about all those poor children that they're saying have no thyroid deformities after sucking up radiation for 4 years? No, it's unethical, man. But so this statement, it's unethical to expose humans to the kind of radiation that you'd see in a disaster like Fukushima, but you need to be prepared, says Donald Ingber. And guess where he works? A bioengineer at Harvard's Weiss Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, we talked about Weiss Institute multiple times. That is the home of the robo-bees. That is the home of much of the psychotechnology. And yes, they are funded by DARPA. With support from the Food and Drug Administration, yes, we've learned that we should trust them because they're letting all kinds of fraudulent reports be published without any retractions. We read that the other day. With the support from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, he is adapting his, quote, bone marrow on a chip, unquote, to study the effects of harmful radiation and experimental remedies. Other researchers working along similar lines discussed their work on model organs for biodefense applications in a meeting of the American Society for Microbiology, acronym ASM, last week in Washington, D.C. The hope is that these complex three-dimensional systems will mimic human physiology better than do cells grown in a dish or even animals. A common way to form a model organ is to seed cells into channels in a small plastic chip and then feed them with nutrient-rich fluid that flows through the system to mimic blood. These devices can be used individually or connected to other types of organs on chips to approximate a biological system or eventually perhaps an entire human body. You know, as I'm reading this, all I'm envisioning is like every psycho engineered human science fiction movie I've seen all my life with bodies in bubbling lighted tubes full of liquid connected to electrodes growing in the basement of some dark, creepy building. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency plans to announce next month a U.S. $18 million program to link livers on chips with chips that simulate fetal membranes, mammary glands, and developing limbs. Oh, my God. The ultimate aim is to study how environmental contaminants such as dioxin and bisphenol A alter metabolism in these organs once they have been processed by the liver. You mean to tell me that looking at the feminization of human children, human male children, doesn't give you some sort of heads up as to what the bisphenol A has been doing in the bottles and the plastics that we've been giving them for 20 plus years already? The flexibility afforded by model organ systems is especially attractive to researchers who are investigating dangerous pathogens, given the expense of animal studies and the security restrictions required. At the ASM meeting, microbiologist Joshua Powell of the Northwest National Laboratory in Richland, Washington, presented experiments testing the ability of anthrax spores to infect a three-dimensional quote-unquote lung grown from rabbit lung cells. The cells sit at an interface between liquid and air, much as in real lungs. Powell said, that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is very interested in using the system to answer questions such as how many anthrax spores are necessary to cause disease in the body. Oh, yeah, we want them to know that. So, hey, we've been using way too much, Clyde. We don't need 10,000 anthrax spores. Save them. We only need 5. For some viruses in particular, Ingber says researchers, quote, have no idea about the mechanism and they need the mechanism to get new drug targets. Infecting model organs could allow researchers to watch how gene expression and metabolism change in real time. This sort of information could be used to identify an unknown agent during a chemical, biological, or radiological attack by providing baseline data of known agents for comparison. John Wixow, a physiologist at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, and his colleagues have shown that they can rapidly distinguish poisons such as ricin and botulism toxin by analyzing the metabolic activity of cells and will now apply the model organs approach. Researchers have already developed dozens of individual model organs. The next challenge is to hook them all together with the eventual goal of forming an entire human body on a chip, says Kristen Fabre, a program manager for the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland. Notice how these are all like military industrial study centers that include the universities. This would provide a more accurate picture of the effects of drugs, toxins, and other agents on human physiology. Wixgow humorously dubs such a system Homo Chipians, but warns that simulating a human body will not be easy. Among other challenges, the blood substitute that flows between model organs must reach them in the right order and in the right quantity and carry the right nutrients for each organ. But plenty of people are trying. An NCATS-funded project aims at hooking together at least 4 chips and 11 research teams are participating. Hey, listen, the U.S. Defense Department's Advanced Research Projects Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, is supporting the development of techniques to link 10 organs. And its Defense Threat Reduction Agency aims to build 2 4-organ systems. Fabre predicts that some of the systems could be available to academics and industry within the next 5 years, and she is hoping that they will prove especially useful in cases in which animals are poor models for human physiology. As researchers inch closer to that goal, she says, quote, it's like sci-fi comes to everyday life, unquote. Oh, my God. Now, reading something like this out of Scientific American, and I've been talking about this for the last few years, and the way I knew about it was because I follow FBO.gov. That's where they put out all of the requests for quotes and the requests for proposals from the federal agencies to corporations, companies that can provide them services. Everything they're looking to do in the future, it has to be public, even for DARPA. So go to FBO.gov one day if you're bored and you want to find some stuff that's going to make your hair raise on the back of your neck and just plug in DARPA or plug in Army or Marines or Navy or Department of Defense, and you will find some things that you go, huh? All right, so to follow on the tales of that, Pigmine actually dropped me a story this morning out of ABC News that ties into not only something we read about in that story, but something that I had come across a few days ago. And let me pull this up. There was a story out of PreventDisease.com, and we talked about vaccines and this whole anti-vaxxer movement and them with this ridiculousness of wanting to make mandatory vaccines and all the crap that's in the vaccines, et cetera, et cetera. And then when we read that FDA report talking about all the fraud that's been going on, I mean, why would we trust any study that says any of that crap is safe to shoot into our beautiful babies. We don't. We shouldn't. Don't trust what they say. It came out in black and white. The reports have been skewed, and we knew it. We absolutely knew it. But there was a document that came out of PreventDisease.com, and some wonderful person, I hope they had an attorney look at this because I was just like so overjoyed and thrilled. They came out with a document titled The Physician's Warranty of Vaccine Safety that they are proposing. If they try to force these vaccinations on us and our children, we then present them with this form before we take anything. But before I read that form, I want to catch the story that Pigmind dropped me this morning titled What Do Aborted Fetuses Have to Do with Vaccines? And yes, we knew this, but I bet much of America did not. So it makes me kind of happy that mainstream is actually talking about this. It says a small but growing number of parents who object to vaccinating their children on religious grounds say they do so because many common vaccines are the products of cells that once belonged to, yes, aborted fetuses, kind of like in your Pepsi, too. Except this time it wasn't a flavor enhancer. And there is a grain of truth to the statement, but even religious leaders, including a future pope, have said that it shouldn't deter parents from vaccinating their children. Well, maybe that FDA report should. Some childhood vaccines, including the one against rubella, which is part of the MMR vaccine, given to millions of children worldwide for measles, mumps, and rubella, is cultured in WI38 human diploid long fibroblasts, according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's fact sheet on the vaccine's ingredients. Merck, the vaccine's manufacturer, acknowledged that those cells were originally obtained from an electively aborted fetus. They were used to start a cell line, which is a cell multiplied over and over again to produce cells that are consistent of a consistent genetic makeup. The WI38 cell line is used as a culture to grow live viruses that are then used in vaccines. The next heading, vaccines developed using human cell strains. Merck, as well as other vaccine manufacturers, uses two well-established human cell lines to grow the viruses for selected vaccines, Merck said in a statement to ABC News. The FDA has approved the use of these cell lines for the production of these Merck vaccines. Other common vaccines, including those for chickenpox, hepatitis, and rabies, are also propagated in cells originally from legally aborted human fetuses, according to the FDA. Quote, these abortions, which occurred decades ago, were not undertaken with the intent of producing vaccines, says a spokeswoman from the CDC. Phew! The original cells were obtained more than 50 years ago and have been maintained under strict federal guidelines by the American Type Culture Collection, according to Merck. These cell lines are now more than three generations removed from their origin, and we have not used any new tissue to produce these vaccines. Like, that should make it any better. To say that vaccines contain a significant amount of human fetal tissue, as some objectors to the vaccine claim, is misleading, says Dr. Paul Offit, the director of Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. There are perhaps nanograms of DNA fragments still found in the vaccine, perhaps billionths of a gram, he said. You would find as much if you analyzed the fruits and vegetables you eat. What? I would find as much DNA of aborted fucking fetal tissue in my fruits and vegetables? I sure hope not, because if I do, then I'd be asking some big-ass questions, and we're going to look at some of this RNAi technology in Monsanto. Wait till you hear this shit. You know, I'm going to copy and paste that somewhere, because I need to research that statement or contact Dr. Paul Offit to find out exactly what he meant by that. I really, really hope that there are not aborted fetal tissue DNA fragments in my fruits and vegetables. Maybe we need to get Food Babe on this. And to remove human fibroblast cells entirely from vaccines is out of the question, Offit explained, noting that they are necessary because human viruses don't grow well in animal cells. They have also been tested for safety, and the fetal cells can go through many more divisions than most other cells before dying. religious organizations have sided in favor of vaccines as well. Notice how they did that. Let's flip it around because they're trying to get rid of refusing vaccines based upon religious objection. Remember that. They're going after that in California. They're going after it in New York. And I'm sure that they are going to go after it in every state at some point here in the near future. It says religious organizations have sided in favor of vaccines as well, even those generally opposed to abortion. You know what? Somehow I highly doubt that. We should always ask our physician whether the product he proposes for our use is a historical association with abortion, says the National Catholic Bioethics Center on their website. But then goes on to say, quote, one is morally free to use the vaccine regardless of its historical association with abortion. The reason is that the risk to public health if one chooses not to vaccinate outweighs, oh, yes, 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 outweighs the legitimate concern about the origins of the vaccine. The center's position statement continued, this is especially important for parents who have a moral obligation to protect the life and the health of their children and those around them. Yeah, well, how about protecting the life and health of their own children from the shit they're putting in the vaccines? So now let's fast forward to this PreventDisease.com form. It was attached to a story that came out of Collective Evolution. And let me read this. And I don't know, actually, this is not the story I'm thinking of. Hold on one second. There was a really disturbing story the other day that made me think of JJ, actually. And not in a bad way, JJ. It was a woman who had had a run-in with her doctor. Her child, one of her children, were up for their scheduled vaccinations. She brought her child in, and it was, you know, those typical well child visits that they do. And she questioned the doctor and wanted to see the insert package of, and I don't remember, if I can find this quick, we'll read it. Here it is. This is out of VacTruth. If it loads. Bully doctor loses it after informed mother asks questions about vaccines. Listen to this. This just made me so upset. This is pretty much, they didn't fire me, but I bet that's going to happen next time. But this is pretty much what happened to me when I started questioning in the very beginning. Okay, the story starts out. Imagine you are sitting with your financial advisor. His role is to invest your assets, give you retirement and life insurance advice, and even pay certain expenses out of your brokerage account. He sits before you because you assume it is a typical meeting where he goes over your financial plan and discusses options you may choose. Yet something unusual happens. He suddenly turns to you and he says he is investing everything you have in two funds, and your instinct kicks in and your stomach flops. Wait, you have questions. And what about those balloon payments of your debt due in less than a year? How will you pay that? And what if the investments crash and you're left with nothing? This could destroy you. You question your advisor again. It is your decision and choice to make, right? But this man that you have trusted becomes angry. He insists that if you can't trust him and you do not value his opinion to invest as he recommends, then you are fired. You ask to at least see the fund prospectuses, but he skirts that and comments. He skirts that comment, sorry, and says you need to move on. Shocked, you inquire about other normal businesses he handles. Will he go over the big picture? Will he write that check you need paid? Unfortunately, no. Go find yourself a new advisor. Whoa, what just happened? How do you feel? Most likely confused, devastated, saddened, mortified, and appalled at how you thought you trusted this person with everything that you owned. You believed wholeheartedly that he was looking out for your very best interest. This is what happens at the doctor's office. Now let's change the scenario. You are sitting in your pediatrician's office. The nurse asks if you will be getting the next 6-month shot today. You politely decline. She asks you what you wanted to do because it's your decision to make. No big deal, right? And then your doctor walks in. He immediately asks why the nurse crossed off the shot. You mention how you aren't comfortable getting these shots right now and would like to pass. Your doctor says, let's discuss why you don't want them. Okay, no harm, no foul. It's because you are concerned with the ingredients and don't feel that it is necessary to put additional toxins into your child while you're working so hard to keep them out. The doctor, alarmed at this comment, furiously begins to look through the records. Doctor, well, I don't see you had any previous reactions. I've never had this happen. What's changed? You. Actually, I told you before that both of my children became constipated for a week after their 2 month shot, and it has continued. Doctor, well, that's not really an indication of a reaction. You. Actually, I believe our gut is linked directly to the brain, and this is a huge indication that something is going on in my children, and I don't want to take that risk right now. Doctor, I have been administering these vaccines for years, and I have seen the disease dramatically decline. It's all about science, and if you do not believe in science, then we have a problem here. You should just go now. Why did you even come here? Why are you wasting my time? You. I thought this was a well baby visit. I thought you were going to look over my children and tell me how they are developing and how they're doing. Doctor, obviously you don't value my opinion, so we are done. Go find yourself another doctor. Wow, what just happened? How does this scenario make you feel? Is it any different from the one that you had with your advisor? The biggest question to ponder is whether you would have asked any of these questions had you known that the doctor was going to dump you. Unfortunately, it seems to be a standard procedure to forgo asking our pediatrician these questions, but expecting to be able to ask these of our financial advisors. Sadly, the pediatrician scenario just happened to me. That isn't me, it's the writer of this article. I was fired by my pediatrician because I refused 2 shots that actually aren't even mandated by the state of Nevada. When I asked about the vaccine inserts, I was told that yes, he had them, but he basically refused to give them to me. Mine actually did give them to me, and then I started questioning her about ingredients, and she was not too happy about it. Apparently, I was dealing with the doctor's God complex for how dare me wanting to see the inserts instead of taking his word. Sorry, but I'm not sorry. I need more than your word. I need statistics. Let's face it. He said he's seen a dramatic decline of pneumonia in children. What does that mean? Did he used to see 10 cases a year, and now he sees only 2? And if that were the case, that's not a great enough decline for me, given that there weren't many cases to begin with. I'll take my chances and keep the aluminum and the GMO out of my kids. Thanks anyway. I don't believe in science. Of course I believe in science. However, science can be manipulated. It is manipulated every day on a cellular level in food, animal diseases, and even baby creation, as well as viruses. Guys, we know that. And with that FDA report, don't believe any bullshit. So, on the heels of this form comes out that I was so excited about, and I printed this. Physician's warranty of vaccine safety. Give this to your doctor next time he wants to vaccinate your kid. Physician's name with degree goes here. Am a physician licensed to practice medicine in the state province of blank, in the country of blank. My state province license number is blank. And if in the USA, my DEA number is blank. My medical specialty is blank. I have a thorough understanding of the risks and benefits of all medications that I prescribe or administer to my patients. In the case of patient name blank, age blank, who I have examined, I find that certain risk factors exist that justify the recommended vaccinations. The following is a list of said risk factors and the vaccinations that will protect against them. I am aware that vaccines typically contain many of the following fillers: aluminum hydroxide, aluminum phosphate, aluminum sulfate, amphotericin B, animal tissues, pig blood, horse blood, rabbit brain, dog kidney, monkey kidney, chicken embryo, chicken egg, duck egg, calf bovine serum, beta, some of these I don't know how to pronounce, beta propiolactone, fetal bovine syndrome or syndrome serum, formaldehyde, formalin, gelatin, glycerol, human diploid cells originating from human aborted fetal tissue, hydrolyzed gelatin, mercury thimerosal, monosodium glutamate, neomycin, neomycin sulfate, phenyl red indicator, phenoxyethanol, which is antifreeze, potassium diphosphate, potassium monophosphate, polymyxin B, polysorbate 20, polysorbate 80, porcine, which is pig pancreatic hydrosilate of casein, residual MRC5 proteins, sorbitol, triiodobutylophosphate, Vero cells, a continuous monkey line of kidney cells, and washed sheep red blood, and hereby warrant that these ingredients are safe for injection into the body of my patient. I have researched reports to the contrary, such as reports that mercury thimerosal causes severe neurological and immunological damage, and find that they are not credible. I am also aware that some vaccines have been found to have been contaminated with simian virus 40, the SV40, and that the SV40 is causally linked by some researchers to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and mesotheliomas in humans as well as in experimental animals. I hereby warrant that vaccines I employ in my practice do not contain SV40 or any other live viruses. Alternately, I hereby warrant that said SV40 virus and other viruses pose no substantive risk to my patient. I hereby warrant that the vaccines I am recommending for the care of patient's name blank do not contain any tissue from aborted human babies, also known as fetuses. And in order to protect my patient's well-being, I have taken the following steps to guarantee that the vaccines I will use will contain no damaging contaminants. And then there's a whole open section blank for him to write in and the steps taken that he's guaranteed this. I have personally investigated the reports made to VAERS, which is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and state that it is my professional opinion that the vaccines I am recommending are safe for administration to a child under the age of 5 years. The basis for my opinion are itemized in Exhibit A, attached here to Physician's Basis for Professional Opinion of Vaccine Safety. The professional journal articles I have relied upon in the issuance of this physician's warranting of vaccine safety are itemized on Exhibit B attached hereto. The professional journal articles I have read which contain opinions adverse to my opinion are itemized on Exhibit C attached hereto. The reasons for my determining that the articles in Exhibit C are invalid are delineated in Attachment D attached hereto. The next section, hepatitis B. I understand that 60% of patients who are vaccinated for hepatitis B will lose detectable antibodies to hepatitis B within 12 years. I understand that in 1996, only 54 cases of hepatitis B were reported to the CDC in the 0 to 1 year age group. I understand that in the VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Reporting database, there were 1,080 total reports of adverse reactions from the Hep B vaccine in 1996 in the 0 to 1 year age group and 47 deaths reported. Did you hear that? There were only 54 cases of Hep B in children up to 1 year of age, but 47 deaths occurred in that same year from the vaccine, as well as 1,080 adverse reactions. I understand that 50% of patients who contract Hep B develop no symptoms after exposure, and I understand that 30% will only develop flu-like symptoms and will have a lifetime immunity. I understand that 20% will develop the symptoms of the disease, but that 95% will fully recover and have lifetime immunity. I understand that only 5% of the patients who are exposed to Hep B will become chronic carriers of the disease, and I understand that 75% of the chronic carriers will live with an asymptomatic infection, and only 25% of the chronic carriers will develop chronic liver disease or liver cancer 10 to 30 years after the acute infection. In addition to the recommended vaccinations as protections against the above-cited risk factors, I, the doctor, have also recommended other non-vaccine measures to protect the health of my patient and have enumerated said non-vaccine measures on Exhibit D attached here too. I am issuing this physician's warranty of vaccine safety in my professional capacity as the attending physician to patient's name, blank. Regardless of the legal entity under which I normally practice medicine, and remember, all these assholes are protected against you suing them, I am issuing this statement in both my business and individual capacities and hereby waive any statutory, common law, constitutional, UCC, international treaty, and any other legal immunities from liability lawsuits in the instant case. I issued this document of my own free will after consultation with competent legal counsel whose name is blank, an attorney admitted to the bar in the state province of blank. Name of attending physician, signature of attending physician, signed in front of a notary public. Ha 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 ha! And I'll tell you what. The reports are not one doctor, not one, has signed that form that's been given it. So let that be a lesson. These assholes have no idea what they're injecting into your kids, nor will they ink their name to tell you that this shit is safe for your children. I thought that was awesome. I just wanted to share that with you. I know that was kind of long-winded. All right. Let's take a look over here. Let's go over to the shit that pisses me off page. Yeah, that's a good one. All right. You know what? We haven't played a video yet, and it's already past half of the show. So let's do this. I played this one a few times. But don't think that any of this stuff is accident, because remember this. Maybe. Hold on. Here it comes.
Sapien 2.0. According to a researcher at the Global Brain Institute, a completely new human species will inhabit the Earth in just over 30 years. Now, this evolutionary step could be comparable to the transition from apes to humans. So what kind of people will we become? Well, they say our biological clocks will undergo dramatic changes, which will allow us to live longer and give birth at an older age. And of course, technology will continue to make our lives easier. All kinds of microchip implants will be placed in our ears and our fingers and make many devices completely obsolete. But this dependence on technology has its drawbacks, of course. In the future, humans are going to have to compete for jobs against, you guessed it, machines and cyborgs. And since most of the work will already be done and automated by robots, a sedentary way of life will ultimately take over and make us all a little bit bigger.
Every time I hear this, hold on, I need to disconnect. I can't stand that hiss when I open up the other Skype. So we're going to have a sedentary lifestyle, and it's going to make us all absolutely useless. I just saw a story that came out of Anti-Media last night. And I mean, we've been talking about this forever. Remember Jibo, the Jibo robot that I just want to, like, smash to pieces? Well, let's see who wrote this one. I think it's JG. Yeah. This is a JG story. First robot designed to live with humans is an uncooperative egomaniac. One of Japan's largest cell phone carriers, SoftBank, which they're here as well. We dealt with SoftBank with the company that I worked for back in the mid-90s, actually, has created the first humanoid robot that is designed specifically for living with humans. The company claims that the robot, Pepper, is the first example of artificial intelligence that can feel and understand emotion. And, you know, Pepper, I would say, is not the very first, because Pepper, if you remember, well, not Pepper, but Jibo, that's what Jibo was about, was being able to understand emotions as well. However, with a quick demonstration with Pepper shows that it has a difficult time with emotion and is in fact an egomaniac. Regardless of the question that it's asked, any conversation usually leads back to Pepper. Pepper is not designed to help around the house, but is instead designed to help psychologically by providing companionship for people. Yeah, and I'm sure much more, because listen to this. His head has four microphones and two HD cameras in the mouth and in his forehead, and a 3D depth sensor behind the eyes. There's a gyroscope in the torso and touch sensors in the head and hands. The mobile base has two sonars, six lasers, and three bumper sensors and a gyro. He's scheduled for release this month in Japan and costs around $1,900. I mean, guys, if this isn't like the biggest surveillance tool on the block, and they're going to sell it to your old people to help you with and your kids to help them with their homework. I mean, remember that freaking Jibo? Unbelievable. So it's coming, and it's coming fast. All right, one of the things now I want to hop on is RNAi. We've looked at this a few times. One of the Ebola, and there were a bunch of different Ebola creation vaccinations that they were working on. I actually outlined all those in a story yesterday. Here, there is a website. I didn't actually go through all these, but if you really want to look at all the different technologies that they were using for all the different drugs that are now lined up for human trials on the Ebola, the quote-unquote Ebola outbreak, the emergency that then allowed all this experimental technology to now be allowed in humans, the website is GenScript, GenScript.com. And the article is titled Ebola Virus: Development of Vaccines and Therapeutic Drugs. This goes through all the different technologies being utilized in these vaccinations. And don't think that these technologies are just going to be used for Ebola, because they won't. This is all of this new Frankenstein science that they're being able to inject in people to see what happens. And typically it's the Africans or the Indians or some dumb people lining up at Oxford University that are healthy that want to be injected. There actually were a bunch in the United States as well that lined up for some of those Ebola vax. And I mean, healthy people. Like, how crazy is that? All right, so let's look at this RNAi technology, because it's totally 100% connected to everything we've been talking about. RNAi stands for RNA interference. RNA interference, RNAi, is a biological process in which RNA molecules inhibit gene expression, typically by causing the destruction of specific mRNA molecules. Historically, it was known by other names, including co-suppression, post-transcriptional gene silencing, and quelling. Only after these apparently unrelated processes were fully understood did it become clear that they all describe the RNAi phenomenon. Two gentlemen shared the 2006 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for their work in RNA interference in the nematode worm, which they published in 1998. Two types of small ribonucleic acid molecules, microRNA, which is miRNA, and small interfering RNA, which is siRNA, are central to RNA interference. RNAs are the direct products of genes, and these small RNAs can bind to other specific messenger RNA molecules and either increase or decrease their activity. For example, by preventing a messenger RNA from producing a protein. RNA interference has an important role in defending cells against parasitic nucleotide sequences, i.e. viruses and transposons. It also influences development. The RNAi pathway is found in many eukaryotes, including animals, and is initiated by the enzyme Dicer, which cleaves along double-stranded RNA molecules into a short double-stranded fragment of less than 20 nucleotide siRNAs. Now, a couple buzzwords here. Eukaryotes, we heard Sophia Smalstrom talking about, and yes, all of us have eukaryotes, all animals. We also heard them talking about interference with this RNA interference of the production of genes and with the production of proteins, as well as the growth of viruses. Now, remember some of what we heard Dr. Huber talking about. Now, RNAi was in an experimental stage until the quote-unquote Ebola outbreak as a use for vaccinations. But now the genie has been let out of the bottle. They've actually used it in humans. It's moved beyond second-level testing. And now it's in large-scale testing. I don't remember how many people. It was maybe 10,000 people now was this newest, in Liberia, I think it was this newest test that they were doing. RNAi is a so they're injecting this shit into people. RNAi is a valuable research tool both in cell culture and in living organisms because synthetic dsRNA introduced into cells can selectively and robustly induce suppression of specific genes of interest. RNAi may be used for large-scale screens that systematically shut down each gene in a cell. Now, do you want that in your body? Something that they can program to systematically shut down each gene in your cells, which can help identify the components necessary for a particular cellular processes or an event such as cell division. What? We can shut down cell division? Well, gee, that would make you kind of dead now, wouldn't it? This pathway is also used as a practical tool in, biotechnology, medicine, and insecticides. Yeah, biotechnology, medicine, and insecticides. I most certainly want something that does all those things in my body, which is why we're going to take a look at now RNAi technology in Monsanto products. And I've had this document queued up here for about a month, so we are going to hit it now. It is titled Muzzled by Monsanto. Is Big Agriculture Squelching Research Showing Its New RNAi GMOs May Be Dangerous? Now, this is the stuff that I am pretty certain that Dr. Huber is finding in the soils and in the animals. After nearly 30 years studying how plants use their genes to defend against viruses, Vicky Vance, a professor at the University of South Carolina, doesn't see genetically modifying plants as a malevolent or arrogantly godlike endeavor. Quote, there's DNA in the world and it gets passed from one organism to another, and it's the natural thing. If that's the problem you have with transgenic plants, which that's another word for GMO, that's not a good reason to be against them, she says. She does, however, have a problem with mega corporations allegedly using their money and power to hide the risks of new forms of genetic technology. Quote, I didn't used to be an anti-GMO person, and I didn't used to have strong feelings about Monsanto, but ... she says with her voice trailing off. But that was before the Chinese research, before the calls from Monsanto, before she couldn't get funding for her work that she feels could change the way we treat cancer and other diseases. Her research, put her at odds with one of the most powerful corporations in the world. Vance isn't a nobody in the world of RNA research. At the June 2011 conference hosted by the nonprofit International Life Sciences Institute, a group of academics, regulatory professionals from the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Agriculture's Environmental Risk Assessment Program, and members of the biotech industry gathered in Washington, D.C., they came to evaluate the environmental risks of a promising new technique to protect crops against pestilent insects, a gene-regulating process called RNA interference. Vance wasn't just an attendee at the conference. She provided the introduction for the event. She studied small interfering ribonucleic acid molecules, the siRNA, in plants for most of her career. Her name appears often in academic papers and conference proceedings on the topic of gene silencing, the main function of so-called RNAi technology. At that time, views of Vance and other attendees were relatively positive. Quote, no plausible risk hypotheses were identified that can be considered unique to RNAi mechanisms when compared to other genetically engineered plants with similar traits. At the time, quote, at the time I was like, hell yes, it's safe. How is this going to be dangerous, said Vance. The corn rootworm will take up these siRNAs, which turn off production of essential proteins in the pests. This is very much what Dr. Huber was talking about. Apparently, it works really well. Otherwise, you'd have to use pesticides, chemicals that are toxic. So instead of using pesticides, they're just going to physically turn off the ability of the insect that eats this stuff to ingest and to grow proteins in its body, to produce proteins in its body that are necessary for life. But her stance on RNAi as a pesticide would change shortly after the conference. And we actually found in reading the 2014 research statements for Monsanto that this was all the rage in their research. This is what they dedicated all of last year to. RNAi has applications in both the medical world and in agriculture. And yes, they're using it in both. But these two worlds are not the same, are not after the same thing when it comes to RNA. While the medical community is trying to perfect processes that will cause the human body to accept modified RNA strands, agriculture corporations working in the GMO field are busy trying to prove that their RNA strands can't be assimilated by the human body at all. Well, bullshit. For example, some microRNAs interfere with cell division and block cancer. These tumor suppressor RNAs are missing in cancer patients. If they can be replaced in experimental treatment known as microRNA replacement therapy, then doctors could theoretically stop the proliferation of cancer cells. But in agriculture, where RNA is being engineered as a pesticide designed to kill insects that feed on crops, such as Monsanto's RNA effort aimed at the western corn rootworm, the most economically destructive pest in the corn production, it is paramount that RNA in and or on the corn that is later eaten by humans doesn't subsequently infiltrate our cells, causing who knows what kind of unintended consequences. Well, Dr. Huber found differently. In short, the medical world needs the genetically modified RNA to be assimilated by our bodies, and the agricultural world needs the opposite to occur. In September of 2011, 3 months after Vance gave her presentation, a team led by Chen Yizhang of Nanjing University in China published a paper in the Journal of Cell Research claiming that mammals, mice in the case of their study, take up small RNAs when they eat plants, and that those plant RNAs regulate expression of mammalian genes, something the science world refers to as trans-kingdom gene regulation. The team reported finding small RNA molecules in the bloodstream and the tissue of mice and humans, and they found that one particular molecule of RNA from rice could inhibit the protein that supports the removal of low-density lipoprotein or bad cholesterol from the blood. If such a finding is proved to also be true for humans, it would potentially indicate that eating foods containing modified RNA could have major implications for heart disease and other health-related issues to cholesterol. This has never been reported before. No one had thought about that, said Vance. What the hell? I mean, you're eating a plant and you're taking in plant RNAs and they're regulating the expression of your genes? I think that has to be considered. And there's a lot of resistance to that paper. When something really unexpected like that comes up, there's always a lot of resistance. Well, again, think about what Dr. Huber said. They were finding it in the animals that were eating these genetically modified crops that had this substance in it that he didn't know what it was yet. Well, it was this new technology. And remember, too, that interview was quite a number of years old. This work was so controversial that another preeminent journal, Nature Biotechnology, made a rather unusual move. They published a letter from a team detailing the negative findings. In other words, it was a study that presents no new conclusions, only an unsuccessful attempt to recreate Zhang's findings. The new report, resulting from collaborations between MI Ranging Therapeutics and Monsanto, of course, clarifies that were controversial findings in the Zhang study. The latter study sparked vigorous debate because it reported the presence of plant microRNA in human blood plasma and suggested that one in particular, miRNA, from ingested rice could traverse into the circulation of mice, resulting in the modulation of miRNA target genes in the animal. I'm going to run out of time. This is a really long story. You know what? Why don't we pick up here tomorrow? This is like five more scrolls down. But here's the thing. Just know that they are selling this stuff to us as being safe. They are selling this stuff to us as being tested. Yet there are professionals out there that are ringing the alarm bell saying, wait a second, this stuff may not be safe. Wait a second, we're finding this in the animal kingdom. It is crossing over and it is making changes to our bodies. What? Oh, there's going to be a brand new human in the next 30 years. How the hell do you think that's going to happen? It's going to happen by putting this Frankenstein shit. It's the same stuff that's in the new vaccines. And they're going to deliver it with their little nano payload to targeted cells in the body. All right, it is about 35 seconds until the bumper. I hope I didn't make your heads hurt too much this morning. I know it was a lot, but you know, it's Wednesday. It's not Monday. So by Wednesday, you got to have your thinking caps on. So if anybody wants to do a little bit of research on RNAi and nanoparticles, that may be a good spot to start up. I just see it right here. Therapeutic approaches for Ebola. siRNA delivered through lipid nanoparticles. Tecmira. Weren't they the ones that were financed by DARPA? Tecmira is developing an RNAi-based therapeutic. All right, guys. Everybody make sure you stick around for Wednesday. We have live Josh with the Anti-Tyranny News at 6 p.m. The Boys from New York at 8. Truth or Talk with April and Burstein at 9, and Anti-Media with Nick and TV at 11. All right, guys, everyone, stay warm, stay safe. I think we'll catch